The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, under President Trump's push to detain and deport undocumented immigrants, the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School is providing advice to families who are concerned about their children during back-to-school season. And an organization representing public school districts in New York State has published a report to assist districts attract teachers during a national shortage. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. As students head back to school, a Columbia Law School professor says immigrant families should take steps to protect their children and themselves during President Donald Trump's heightened immigration enforcement. Elora Mukherjee, director of the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School, says families should make emergency plans. Parents should speak with their children about the possibilities of arrest and deportation, and families should consider what to do if someone is detained. I asked Mukherjee if she's aware of any immigration and customs enforcement actions at public schools across the country.
I have not heard of confirmed cases of ICE raids or arrests in public schools. That said, there is tremendous fear about the possibility of ICE raids and arrests in and near public schools. We're seeing the effects of that fear. Student attendance is down. There's heightened anxiety among children, parents, caregivers, school administrators, and school administrators are trying to figure out how to deal with this new moment. Historically, immigration enforcement did not take place in schools. For many years, the Department of Homeland Security had a policy known as the Sensitive Locations Memo in place. And the Sensitive Locations Memo basically prohibited immigration enforcement at locations such as schools, hospitals, and places of worship. But in January 2025, that memo was rescinded, opening up the possibility that immigration raids could take place within schools.
I wanted to know more about how immigrant families are feeling about sending their kids back to school in this era of immigration enforcement. And just sort of to get a handle on the number of families that are keeping their children home, do you have an estimate of how many families may be across the country keeping their kids out of school due to fear of deportation or arrest?
That's a great question, Lucas. I don't have a nationwide estimate on that number, but I think as the school year continues and school opens up throughout the country, we may be able to get that type of data. In terms of the effect on children and families, what I would say is all children, regardless of their citizenship status and their immigration status, are allowed under our U.S. Constitution to go to school, to go to public school. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1982 that free and public education must be made available to all kids, regardless of their immigration status, and that schools must not engage in practices and policies that might discourage enrollment or attendance due to how families are classified under immigration law. That's the case, the seminal case called Plyler v. Doe. And unfortunately, there are efforts in various states across the country to undermine the protections of the Plyler decision.
So do you have any guidance for any families or parents that may be listening? Where can they get more information about how to protect themselves if they feel like their child or themselves are at risk, regardless of their legal status?
Families should take a few steps to prepare for the worst case scenario. First, families whose immigration status is not secure in the United States should organize all of their important identity documents and keep the originals in a safe and secure location that a few trusted individuals have access to. They should also scan all of those documents and make them available to a few trusted individuals in case a person in the family is detained or arrested or otherwise subject to deportation proceedings. Second, families with children should make plans for who would take care of their children in the event of an emergency. This can include both short-term caregiving responsibilities as well as long-term caregiving responsibilities. Families across the country where parents are undocumented are facing very difficult choices right now about whether they would bring their children back to their home country in the event that the parents are detained and deported, or whether they would leave their children here in the United States with a trusted caregiver. For families who are facing those decisions, it may be important to execute a power of attorney that designates who would take care of your children if they are left behind or in the event that a parent is detained for an extended period of time. Families should also consider basic Know Your Rights information. A person does not need to open the door if there is someone who is unknown on the other side of the door. If an unknown person shows up at your home and is knocking at your door, you don't need to open the door unless they can present a federal judicial warrant. Often, ICE carries out enforcement actions without using a federal judicial warrant. They often rely on administrative warrants, and this is not sufficient under the Fourth Amendment to require people to open the doors of their homes. Only if a warrant is signed by a federal judge does a person need to open their door and let an ICE officer in.
Now, I wanted to go back to what you had said about emergency plans and making sure that families have all of their information, and how does having all of this information together impact the outcome? Does it allow for maybe a faster processing, or allowing that individual to be connected with an attorney or to be put in communication with loved ones sooner? What are the benefits of having that information all together in one place?
There are myriad benefits to having the information in one place. If a person is arrested and detained, the first thing a family should do is try to figure out where their loved one is. There is an online resource called the ICE Detainee Locator that families can use to find their loved ones who've been disappeared. That locator is updated about 48 hours after a person's arrest, so the information may not be available immediately. But as soon as you know where your loved one is, it's important to make sure, if you can, that they have access to legal counsel. And a trustworthy immigration lawyer will want evidence to prove the identity of the person who is detained, what country they're from, how long they've been in the United States, whether they're forms of immigration relief that may be available to them. If a person has been in the United States for longer than 2 years, and you can prove that the person has been in the United States for longer than 2 years, then the person should not be subjected to expedited removal. That means a summary deportation process from the United States that can literally take a few days. So it's important to have a person's information organized, because the time pressure is pretty intense after a person is in detention to try and stop their swift removal from the U.S.
Now, I also just wanted to zoom out a little further about these actions by President Trump and his use of emergency wartime executive authority to enforce these actions. I wanted to know your thoughts on the legality of the president's actions. And do you believe that this is in violation with the Constitution in any way?
The president's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act is unconstitutional and illegal. The Alien Enemies Act should only be used in times of declared wars declared invasions by a foreign government. That's not what we're seeing here when President Trump has invoked the Alien Enemies Act against Tren de Aragua, which is a criminal gang based in Venezuela. Tren de Aragua is not a government, and we are not in a time of declared war. So the president's use of the Alien Enemies Act violates separation of powers principles in the Constitution and violates myriad federal immigration laws. What we're seeing is an executive branch that is intent on pushing the bounds of its executive authority well beyond the system of checks and balances that has been set up in the U.S. Constitution. And the place where the president is pushing most aggressively on executive power is immigration. This is why we're seeing a president who is seeking to deport many thousands of people without affording them due process of law, targeting individuals who are non-citizens for their speech in violation of the First Amendment, and taking actions that offend basic human dignity and basic principles that many Americans would abide by. Lucas, can I just share one last thought on that?
Absolutely, yeah.
For all families who are listening to this program and are considering whether or not to send your children to school, I would encourage you to please send your kids to school. School can offer an important respite for children in these tumultuous times and affords them invaluable opportunities to learn and access resources that will be helpful for their lives and can potentially enrich your entire family's life. It's also worth noting that the same Fourth Amendment protections that apply to a person's home, they should apply in the school setting too. Law enforcement agents, ICE agents, would be required to have a warrant signed by a federal judge before entering a school building. They shouldn't simply be relying on administrative warrants issued by their own agencies when they're carrying out or seeking to carry out immigration enforcement in schools.
Elora Mukherjee is director of the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. As students and teachers prepare to head back to the classroom in New York, a statewide organization representing local districts has released a report on how to address a teacher shortage in New York. The New York State School Boards Association this week published its report called Plug and Play: Strategies for Addressing Teacher Shortages at the Local Level. The report finds that shortages are concentrated in select subjects, including career and technical education, health sciences, English language arts, science, special education, and library media. The report makes several recommendations, including making compensation more attractive for potential teachers. I spoke with New York State School Boards Association spokesperson David Albert to learn more.
So, you know, this is something that needs to be obviously discussed at a local level between the school district management, the Board of Education, the administration, as well as the collective bargaining unit for teachers in that school district. But we thought if we're going to be talking about recruiting teachers, and if we are looking at a moment in time when we do have shortages, then I think we can certainly throw compensation into the mix as far as factors to be considered. We do think that teachers here in New York State are paid well comparatively to other states. However, when you look at those who have a bachelor's degree, data from the U.S. Census Bureau found that classroom teachers in New York earn about $20,000 less than for all people with bachelor's degrees. Now, obviously, you're throwing in people who have engineering, computer science, finance, lots of different degrees that tend to skew those numbers higher. But the fact of the matter is, it is something that, that schools need to consider in discussion with their collective bargaining units. And we have found as we worked on this report that the profession or the field of teaching is kind of at an all-time low when it comes to reputation or prestige, if you will. So we think, you know, obviously this is something that districts need to consider, they need to obviously consider job prestige, and part of that is compensation. But there's also other factors beyond compensation, which is the district culture, which is opportunities for professional development. All of those things should be woven into a package that can attract good quality teachers to our schools.
Now, I do want to just shift gears for a moment and talk about some of the changes that we're seeing at the federal level as the Trump administration has moved forward with the Federal Department of Education and the downsizing there. How is that having any ripple effects in New York as school districts look at their finances, as they prepare for the upcoming school year? How have those federal cuts and rollbacks impacted the state?
Yeah, so at this point in time, we haven't seen a lot of impact here in New York. I would say that, first of all, federal funding is a relatively small percentage of education funding here in New York State, so it's probably about 6% of education funding. So state and local funds make up the vast majority of education funding. In addition, most federal funding comes to schools in the form of Title I, which is for schools that have high levels of poverty, as well as IDEA for students with disabilities. So we haven't seen cuts to those areas here at this point for New York schools. Going forward, it could potentially be problematic, but at this particular time, you know, we haven't gotten any indication that there'd be cuts for students, you know, programs for students with disabilities. And again, you know, the primary focus here in New York for schools is really on state support and then local funding as well. With regard to the Department of Education, you know, schools here in New York, are really under the watch of the State Board of Regents. We do have obviously federal programs that we have to comply with, and we're seeing that some of those programs could potentially be transferred to other federal agencies, such as the Department of Labor, with like career and technical education, or some programs could get transferred over to Health and Human Services. So that's really kind of a wait and see at this point. And I think the primary concern for schools would just be that programs, you know, that are federally funded and that impact students would continue to be funded. But, you know, we have to kind of wait and see at this point. And I think we haven't seen a huge impact as of yet here in New York.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with David Albert from the New York State School Boards Association. David, there are a lot of changes at the state that are going into effect for this upcoming school year, notably a bell-to-bell ban on cell phones and smartphones in schools, connected devices. Now, the school districts across the state have had time over the summer to develop their plans and comply with this new policy. How have school districts been doing, and what do you think about the implementation as the school year kicks off here?
So school districts obviously are complying. I mean, there was a date of August 1st to essentially develop a policy for compliance. So my understanding is that a vast majority of districts have actually developed their policies. They're posted. I know the governor has a website where you can view your school district's policies. So our perspective on this is, you know, we weren't really supportive of a statewide bell-to-bell ban. We felt that school boards are elected by their communities, that they should be empowered to create a policy that makes sense in their community. So there's other options besides just bell-to-bell. Bell-to-bell is draconian, basically says from the time you arrive at school in the morning till the time you leave, you essentially have no access to your phone. We thought that boards should be able to work with their communities and come up with perhaps alternatives where there'd be no cell phone in the classroom, but maybe during a break, you know, you would be allowed to check your cell phone, something along those lines. But that being said, we do have a bell-to-bell ban. Districts are complying. I think that, you know, some districts had these in place already. There's no question that having a cell phone in the classroom can be distracting. We agree with that, and we don't really think that there's a place for a phone in the classroom unless it's being used as part of instruction or if there's a special circumstance, which the law does allow for special circumstances. So it's good in that respect. But again, we just really felt that schools should have some flexibility there. And there was some funding that was put aside in the state budget. It was about $13.5 million for districts to procure storage items. So if they wanted to have, you know, some type of storage system in place for students who bring their cell phones to school, they store them. The funding was available. It did come out a little bit late. I think it came out later this summer. So that it would have been, you know, good for that funding to be released a little bit earlier. But that being said, you know, districts are complying, and you know, we'll have a cell phone ban in place starting next week.
There are new graduation requirements that the state is rolling out. It calls it the portrait of a graduate, and there is a number of changes that come with that. And also the proposal to have the Regents exams no longer be a graduation requirement. How does the School Boards Association feel about the changing New York State graduation requirements?
Yeah, so, you know, this goes to the recommendations of the Blue Ribbon Commission on Graduation Measures, and the State Education Department has a plan for implementation, which they call New York Inspires. So those new graduation changes are going to be phased in. And I think that the Education Department is really kind of looking at, you know, what is the workforce need, you know, what are the skills that and kind of the base of knowledge that a student needs to have in order to be successful in post-secondary education. So we think that it's good for the state to be reevaluating what it means to be a successful high school graduate here in New York State. You know, the world has changed so much. I mean, if you look at just where we are today compared to 10, 15 years ago, I mean, the jobs are changing. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, we didn't have, you know, people who were skilled in writing prompts for artificial intelligence. We didn't need people who were, you know, adept at social media. I mean, the world has changed, technology changes, and so the skills that we teach in schools need to move with those changes as well. So they are going to move toward a one diploma, which is a phase-in process. I believe this year, this school year, is phase one of the move toward these new graduation standards, and basically includes new credit requirement information. So what, you know, credits were required in, you know, previously, such as 4 credits of English or, you know, 3 credits of math, science, et cetera, those could be changing. But basically, you know, we think it's a good thing that the state is taking a look at where we are in terms of teaching students and really making them as successful, or at least preparing them to be as successful as they can be for the world beyond high school.
And lastly, David, I wanted to ask you about the switch to electric school buses from fossil fuel-powered vehicles. And this has been an issue that's been controversial for a number of years, particularly in upstate New York. How does the School Boards Association feel about the state's rollout so far? There have been lawmakers that have pushed for exemptions and delays. What's your take on it?
Well, we have reservations about the ability of school districts to meet the deadlines that are associated with the zero emission bus mandate. I think that the transition timeline goes like to 2035, which is really not that far away. and there's a point at which, you know, you'll no longer be able to purchase diesel buses, which is much earlier, much sooner. So there's just a lot of questions about this right now. I mean, we could go down the list. First is cost. It costs close to $500,000 for one electric school bus, whereas the cost for a diesel bus is about $150,000. So if you want to do the math and take a look at, you know, a district that has a couple dozen buses in its fleet, doing that conversion is going to be pretty expensive. Second, the purchase of a school bus in New York State requires the approval of voters in the school district. It hasn't always been easy to get that approval. So that poses a real problem for schools because they can't comply with a mandate if the voters are not authorizing them to purchase buses. So it doesn't happen everywhere, but it does happen. So that's certainly a concern. Third, infrastructure. Do we have the infrastructure in place to charge these electric vehicles? And, you know, that's obviously a big deal because if you're driving your car down the road and you run out of gas and there's no gas station, you know, that's not a good situation. Same is true for an electric vehicle. Obviously, you know, schools aren't going to let that scenario happen. But the point is you need to be able to charge them. And we're not sure that the infrastructure is really in place right now. Battery ranges, you know, along with the question of infrastructure, you know, we're not really sure that the battery ranges are really holding up to what the manufacturers say that they are. So there's really just a lot of concerns right now, and I know that the state has responded by including the possibility of granting waivers to the 2027 purchase deadline, which is when the districts will have to transition to just purchasing electric or zero emission vehicles. So we'll see. Obviously, we understand that the goal here is to try to be more environmentally friendly. We just have to really take a look at the practical implications of this mandate.
David Albert is Chief Communications and Marketing Officer at the New York State School Boards Association. Dave, thanks again for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1820. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.